12th century by St. Dominic for combating the heresy of Albigensianism. Jesuits were founded in the 16th century by Ignatius Loyola to combat the heresy of Protestantism. How many Albigensians have you met lately? Now, at a Jesuit place, we tell jokes on Opus Dei, but...
Life.
What's an ism? Not just a worldview. Everybody has a worldview. And everybody has a life view. A Weltanschauung and a Lebensschauung. And the two are always connected. And intellectually, the life view is always based on and justified by the worldview. You can't have an ethic without a metaphysic, even though most philosophers today want to do that. But an ideology is not just a worldview. An ideology, at least as it's usually used, is something post-Kantian, something subjective, generated, willed into existence by the human mind and or will, and therefore something conventional rather than something natural, and usually something political, and usually something pragmatic, some sort of propaganda, which is a proper mate for a proper goose. Probably can't, never mind. So, I will talk about four isms. First one is atheism and the secularism that it spawns, and then pantheism, and then sexism, and then a whole host of other religious isms. Almost all atheists are materialists. And, of course, secularists, because religion is the acknowledgement of some sort of higher power. I teach a course in world religions, and I begin with the question, define the word religion, and they can't do it, because it's either too narrow, like worship of a god, or too broad, such as a worldview. The closest I've ever come to an acceptable universal definition of religion is AA's definition, some sort of higher power. And almost all atheists are also humanists and deny that there exists any kind of higher power. So, in talking about atheism, I'll also be talking about materialism and humanism and secularism. The intellectual reasons for atheism are summarized nicely by Thomas Aquinas in the famous article on the existence of God in the Summa. He always tries to give at least three objections to every one of his theses. He can only find two on this most important thesis of all. It's obviously the most important, because if there is no God, you can't do 4,000 pages of talking about God. And the two arguments that he can find are, one, evil, and two, science. If one of two contraries is infinite, the other cannot exist. God means infinite goodness, therefore if there were a God, there would be no evil. There is evil, therefore there is no God. That's the shortest, simplest, and most elegant formulation of the problem of evil that I've ever seen. And even in his day, they knew enough about science to claim that everything is explainable by the natural and human sciences with no remainder. Therefore, God is a useless hypothesis. Even before Occam's razor, they knew about Occam's razor. They just didn't call it Occam's razor. It's obviously not a scientific explanation to explain why this podium stands up here, not by gravity and the nature of wood, but by some sort of battle taking place between good and evil spirits. So the argument is that you don't need God any more than you need the Loch Ness Monster or other mythical creatures. That, by the way, doesn't prove that there is no God. So the only argument that even claims to prove that there is no God is the problem of evil. The classic answer to the problem of evil is I think the strongest version is that the very precondition of their being evil and being able to judge that a thing is more or less evil is that there is a true and real standard of goodness. And if that standard is merely subjective, then our judgments are merely subjective and not worth anything. And if that standard is only relative, then we can't judge relative things by it. You need an absolute standard to judge relative things. That's true even in math. 9 is larger than 8 because it's closer to infinity. So the implicit presupposition of the problem of evil is that there is a supreme good, which sounds suspiciously like God. And the strongest answer to the objection that the atheists today usually focus on, namely science, is to say that science explains everything is to forget that science doesn't explain science. The correspondence between the human mind and objective reality is a preordained correspondence. Can that be explained simply by natural selection, by random chance, by saying that the brain is the mind and the brain is something like a computer and it has been programmed by unintelligent electrical charges and atoms bumping into each other blindly? That's rather like saying that the plane that you're riding on today is perfectly safe, even though the pilot and the co-pilot have both died, because it is being run by an autopilot, which is based on a computer that was programmed last night by a random fall of hailstones out in the middle of a football field. But I'm sure you've all had many classroom exposures to the arguments for and against the existence of God. What's more relevant, especially if you're thinking not merely of satisfying your own intelligence, but if you're thinking of actually helping people and thinking that you might meet atheists, or at least people who are tempted to atheism. I suspect there's a little atheist even in the theist lurking there as a temptation, just as there's a little tempting theist at the heart of the atheist, so there's an interior dialogue going on in every human heart. So what's more relevant, if you're actually talking to a living human being who either is an atheist or flirting with atheism, is what are their real motives? What's moving them in that direction? Because motives are stronger than reasons. Freud, unfortunately, is right. Most reasoning is rationalizing. Most of us believe what we want to believe because we want to believe it. But then, of course, reason clicks in and says, well, wait a minute, let's be honest. You have to have reasoning. The relation between desire and reason is obviously a very complex relationship and obviously works both ways. And whether it's working from the bottom up, namely desire moving reason, is stronger than moving from the top down, that is reason moving desire. Whether that's true or not, it's certainly powerful. So we have to deal with that. And that's dealt with less often, I think, than the purely intellectual reasons from the top down. So let me try to expose what I think are the three most prominent and powerful motives for atheism. In three words, they're power, honor, and pleasure. Three things that everybody wants very much. I'm sure you've heard before, and you probably believe, I think rightly, that ultimately you're an atheist because you don't want to be number two. You want to be number one. I love Rodney Dangerfield's one-liner. When you're looking out for one number one, watch out, you're going to step on number two. I think he said you're step on some number two. So the motive for atheism is pride. Or maybe we should say the fear of humility. the demand for control. People who are proud and arrogant and control freaks are usually cowards. They're usually motivated by fear and distrust. So that an apparently Nietzschean, strong-willed atheist like Ivan Karamazov in The Brothers Karamazov or Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, who wants to prove that there is no God by making himself a Superman and the creator of the moral law rather than under it, such a person is usually a scared little kid. We all know that bullies are really cowards in disguise. And they have to put on this mask to protect their little cowardice. I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know what to do about that fact, but it's certainly important to know that there is that terrified little child at the heart of the great noble Superman.
Was Hitler a coward?
Oh yeah.
How do we see that? How do we know that? How do we see that?
I think the answer to that question is universal rather than particular. Yeah. We don't know, at least I don't know, that much about Hitler's particulars. But why would... No, I'm not gonna argue that. I'll just say that my reply is that it's at least extremely probable that the bully is really a coward. Most bullies, at least, are cowards.
Could you say the cyanide pill was a sign of his cowardice?
Of course. Good answer.
Yeah. What's the question?
A cyanide pill was a demonstration of his cowardice.
Oh, that he killed himself.
Suicide, yeah. Okay, so the demand for power. Secondly, in certain societies, not in most, but in ours, in the society that used to be called Christendom and now can best be called apostate Christendom, that is Western civilization, atheism is a badge of honor and respectability. If you're an atheist, you're a free thinker, at least among the intellectuals, among the elite. We desperately crave to be accepted. David Griesman pointed out in his sociological classic, The Lonely Crowd, back in the 50s, that although every society wants honor, ours has a unique take on honor, because in traditional societies you are honored by being different, by being excellent, by being better than somebody else. Today you're honored for almost the exact opposite reason, for being the same as everybody else and not standing out in any way. At least in your peer group. And if the peer group is, for whatever reason, don't ask me how this happened, why the media elite and the university professors are so massively atheistic in our society, it's a fact. So there's your peer group. And to be patted on the head by that peer group is a kind of substitute for being patted on the head by God. If we're truly humble, like little children, we want to be patted on the head by our Father. And a great and legitimate joy will come to us when, after death, we hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." It's pride not to want that. There is, because of our history, because of the history of Western civilization, which is rooted in Christianity, and then has increasingly repudiated its roots, because of that history, there's a chronological snobbery involved in atheism. We are the people, wisdom began with us. Our ancestors were fools and primitive barbarians. And therefore, the atheist who is affirmed by his peers, his fellow intellectuals, also needs to be repudiated by the masses. That feeds his snobbery. If the masses became atheists, the atheist wouldn't be happy anymore. So in our society, which is still pretty religious, you have to be a snob to be an atheist. Because an atheist is someone who has to believe that the vast majority of all the other people, even today, at least in America, as distinct from something like France, are insane. Freud, in Civilization and Its Discontents, his last and most philosophical book, makes the very reasonable statement that since religion isn't true, since atheism is true, therefore we have to classify all the religions of the world as literally insanity. Collective hallucination. I think that's a very logical consequence. Anybody remember the old movie Harvey with Jimmy Stewart?
Mm-hmm.
Who's Harvey?
The rabbit.
How is Harvey different than other rabbits?
He's invisible.
He's invisible. He's a giant invisible rabbit whom Jimmy Stewart believes in and talks to, and he's the most important person in his life. And in every other way, Jimmy's a very nice, acceptable, normal, sane human being. But he believes in Harvey. He's nuts. Well, God's bigger than Harvey. So if we believe in God, we're more nuts than Jimmy Stewart. That is very reasonable. On the other hand, if atheism is untrue, it's the atheist who's nuts. He's like a kid who goes home for a Thanksgiving vacation and his parents greet him at the door and he doesn't acknowledge them and he looks right through them as if they're transparent, doesn't talk to them, eats the dinner without thanking them for it, goes home for Christmas and rips off each present without wondering where it came from. He's nuts. Somebody's nuts. So, either 95% or 5% of our society is nuts. Well, if you're a snob, you want to be the 5%. But even atheists don't want to be snobs, so I think it bothers an atheist to be told that he has to be a snob. So honor is the second motive. The third, obviously, is pleasure. It's the freedom to do what you feel like. And in modern society, that is 99% about sex. Which I think is a natural and inevitable thing. Thomas Aquinas says in the Summa Theologica, no man can live without joy. Therefore, it is inevitable that one deprived of true spiritual joys will become addicted to carnal pleasures. But of course, if there's no God, there's nobody to tell me that I need to practice the virtue of temperance or self-control. Except maybe purely prudential considerations. Well, there are other motives for atheism, but I think those are the ones we have to realize are there. And therefore, the techniques in dealing with atheists include, I think, a daring to call the demon by its proper name. This is necessary for any exorcism. Names are important. Names are not just labels. So don't be nice. Don't be polite. Don't back off. Call the demon by its name. The atheist needs a shot. Nobody has said that to him before. You have a collar. You're allowed to say it. And, of course, seek out the demon. Go into the ghettos. The gospel has always gone into the ghettos. Seek out the lostest sheep. Go into Harvard. Or Hollywood. Those are our ghettos. And those most deeply into atheism, when converted, become the most precious, the St. Paul's. Imagine if Paul had remained a persecutor of the church. He would have been kind of early Hitler. Or imagine if Hitler had been converted. He could have been a saint with all that passion. Now, St. Augustine was the playboy of the Western world. Mary Magdalene had seven devils. Great saints are made out of great sinners. A car speeding down the road has to make a 180-degree turn to go in the right direction, but that's more likely than a stalled car starting up. It takes more energy to start a car than to change its direction. So seek out the The ones with the passion. The ones that are the most threatening. And dare them. Dare them to look at both sides. Dare them to read things. Make a contract. I'll read Nietzsche if you read Thomas Aquinas. What are you afraid of? I'm sure you've all had many exposures to the arguments against atheism, that is, the arguments for the existence of God. Among Christians, you'll probably get the opposite skepticism from among atheists. Among Christians, the skepticism is usually, what, reason can prove the existence of God? We don't need reason. Whereas among atheists, you say, reason proves the existence of God? We're rational, therefore we don't believe in God. So the role of reason is going to be quite different. Among atheists, you have to plant seeds of doubt. It's kind of fun to be the barbarians at the gates instead of the establishment when you're dealing with the atheist establishment. You know, we're terrorists. We plant bombs, little idea bombs in their heads, prods, unconscious spurs, burrs. And that, I think, is what arguments accomplish the most powerfully. Very rarely will an intelligent person look at an argument, a perfectly valid logical argument, and say, good grief, I've been wrong. We don't like that word, wrong, the W word. One of my favorite old-time TV shows was Happy Days. Some of you remember it. Remember Fonzie, who's very, very cool and doesn't ever want to be uncool and doesn't ever want to admit that he's wrong. In one of these incidents, he made a disastrous mistake. He advised Ralph Mouth, who's a real geeky character, to join the Marines. And Ralph's not happy as a Marine, but Fonzie is God, so he can't question Fonzie's judgment. So Robbie, who's much brighter than Ralph, persuades Fonzie to tell Ralph that that's a mistake. Fonzie says, I can't do that, it's not cool. You have to do it, Fonzie. You're honest. Yeah, I know. Wrong. Okay. He sees Ralph in his Marine uniform. Hey, Ralph. Yeah. Oh, hi, Fonz. How you doing? Okay, how you doing, Ralph? Oh, great, Fonz. Great. Thanks for the advice. This is the meaning of life. And we all know that Ralph's faking it. Ralph, I gotta say something. What, Fonz? You know, that day I told you to join the Marines? Yeah, great advice, Fonz. Thanks a lot. Well, I gotta say something about that. What? Well, I was. Come on. I was. I can't say that word. It's not cool. Constipation. Intellectual constipation. Don't expect anybody to say, on the basis of the world's best argument, I was wrong. At least not to you. But hope that something will say it in them. And then they'll go home and think about it and think some more, and eventually they'll say, I was wrong, to themselves and to God. That's the two people you want them to apologize to. Because they're not going to meet you very much, but they're going to meet themselves every single minute of their lives, and they're going to meet God every single minute of their lives and for all eternity. So plant doubts. I classify all arguments for the existence of God into real arguments and verbal arguments. The ontological argument is the classic case of a merely verbal argument. Nobody's convinced by it. It's perfectly logical, nobody can refute it, and yet nobody's convinced by it. The word God means the being with all perfections, and real objective existence, independent of your mind, is more perfect than existence in the mind, therefore, by definition, God must exist. Yeah, come on, what's the trick? Don't even mention it, don't bother it. Because anybody who looks at the ontological argument will say, aha, that's what all arguments are like. That's Kant's mistake. Kant believed in God, but he wanted to separate faith and reason and refute all the rational arguments for the existence of God. So he said, well, they're all like the ontological argument. And he rightly refuted the ontological argument. So don't mention it. It's the black sheep of the family. To prove a real God, you've got to start with real data. All right, there's two kinds of real data, because our experience is dual, subjective and objective. All human experience, all human thinking, feeling, choosing, desiring, has a thinker, chooser, feeler, desirer, and some object. So you can take your data either from the objective world, and those are usually called cosmological arguments, arguments from the cosmos, or you can take your data from the subjective world. Now, in the Middle Ages, almost everybody preferred the cosmological arguments, because medieval man was about 10 years old, and we're about 18 years old. And the difference between a 10-year-old and an 18-year-old is the 10-year-old wants to know, what's that, what's that, what's that, what's that? But an 18-year-old, or maybe it's an 8-year-old versus a 16-year-old, anyway, a teenager wants to know, who am I? What makes me tick? Am I ugly? Do people love me? Do I have zits? Will I commit suicide? What's the meaning of my life? You ask all those questions about yourself in the teenage years, but not before. And neither is better than the other. They're natural stages of development. So the ancient medieval mind was like the mind of a child. It was brilliant, but it was simple. What's that? What's that? What's that? Objective. The modern mind is much more subjectively oriented. Who am I? And you all know that that's the difference, the fundamental difference between modern philosophy and pre-modern philosophy, the turn to the subject, which is neither bad nor good. But we're modern, and we're talking to modern people, and therefore the psychological arguments are going to be much more interesting and much more effective than the cosmological arguments, even though the cosmological arguments are also interesting and effective and powerful. Don't ignore them. But instead of using the five ways of Aquinas, which they've probably dealt with before, unless they're very ignorant, sometimes you'll have students who don't even know that there are such things as arguments for the existence of God. And they read Aquinas' five ways and say, wow, that's amazing. Never realized that. Anybody ever thought that way before? But most people are intelligent enough to know that you know, the first cause argument is out there. So it's much more challenging to them, I think, to argue from modern science than from medieval philosophy. To point to the fact that, for instance, the cosmologists 30 or 40 years ago were just about united that Big Bang cosmology was theism in disguise. And it couldn't be the Big Bang, because then there had to be a Big Banger, and that's a creator, and that's God, and we can't have God, and therefore the world is oscillating, or a steady state, or anything other than the Big Bang. And now every cosmologist in the world knows that Big Bang has been conclusively proved by many different lines of converging evidence. So they're now trying to figure out how there can be a Big Bang without a Big Banger. And Stephen Hawking, probably the most intelligent man in the world, has come up with a brilliant solution that universes happen. Invisible rabbits don't happen, but universes happen. If you saw a large blue rabbit suddenly appear on the top of my head, you would say, oh, well, large blue rabbits happen. Right? You wouldn't ask why. Of course you would ask why. Well, is it more likely that the entire universe simply pops into existence for absolutely no reason whatsoever? Because it's possible, it's consistent. Well, yes, but a universe with large blue rabbits is also possible and consistent, as well as an infinity of other possible universes. Yeah, and ours is just one of these infinity of possible universes. Yes, but ours is actual. And the one with large blue rabbits is not. So mustn't there be some actual cause? Duh. Unfortunately, very intelligent people don't like that syllable, duh. We have a saying in New England, that idea is so insane that only a PhD could possibly believe it. Because PhDs are intelligent enough to fool themselves, to create all sorts of spider webs in hiding places, where simple people aren't. You can fool a philosopher much more easily than you can fool a farmer. 100 years ago, there were 100 times more farmers than philosophers. Today, there are 100 times more philosophers than farmers. We're in trouble. You can also get some mileage out of intelligent design, as long as you don't claim that it's strict science. It isn't. It can't be quantified. Design is not an empirically verifiable and quantifiable thing, so if they're into hard science, they're going to be skeptical of the argument from design. But it's very commonsensical. The anthropic principle, for instance, the discovery that no universe could possibly evolve human life unless dozens and, in fact, hundreds of tiny windows were opened just exactly that way. If for instance, 3 seconds after the Big Bang, the temperature of the primeval fireball had been a trillionth of a degree hotter or colder, you couldn't ever have carbon. And there's no other possibility for life than carbon. And if the solar system were not calibrated so that the sun was just far enough away and the Earth was just enough tilted on its axis, you wouldn't have life evolving from the oceans. That certainly looks like a plot. There are fingerprints all over the glass. It's almost as if every baby born into the world comes out of the womb with a little label on this tush saying, made in heaven. But I think the psychological arguments give you the most mileage. The deepest one, I think, is the argument from desire. Most psychologists will tell you that we are largely creatures of desire, and that desire is the strongest, most interesting, and most determinative psychological factor in us. Now, if you can identify the desire for God, that may not prove anything, but that will point to a piece of data that can be used for an argument. Now, atheists almost always have this very silly picture of God as the Puritan father in the sky or the gray-bearded grandfather sitting on a throne, which is obviously very silly, and some of them are so uneducated that they really believe that that's what religious people believe. So they first of all have to be educated into the notion that God is not that, but a being who is infinitely good, infinitely beautiful, infinitely true, infinitely perfect. Do they desire that such a being exist? Well, with one part of them, no. Because of the three motives I mentioned before, but with another part of it, yes. The human heart was not designed in Hollywood or Harvard. It was designed in heaven. And therefore, the desire that there be, let's just take one of these attributes, something infinitely beautiful, such that if you were in its presence forever, you would never be bored and never frustrated. Wouldn't that be great? Well, of course. Well, then there is something like a desire that there be a God. If the atheist thinks that Christianity is a series of dull, platitudinous fairy tales, he first of all hasn't read the fairy tales. Secondly, he hasn't read Christianity. If he believes, however, that it's a crazy, wild, fantastic, wonderful fairy tale, much too good to be true, then he's halfway there. And he understands what it is. You might work on the negative half of the argument from desire. The lover's quarrel with the world. How come you're not totally happy? How come you always want something more? How come, for instance, your curiosity isn't satisfied with 501 truths or 501 million truths? How come you always want one more? Why are there some things, truth, love, beauty, goodness, that we can't set a limit to? And therefore, we are always dissatisfied. We always have this restless heart. That will work for some atheists, but in my experience, only a very few. Most of them seriously believe that they could be totally and completely happy forever if they just had creature comforts around them. At least that's what they say. That's the standard line. I don't want to go to heaven. I just want to live as long as I can here. I can't believe that they really believe that. I think that's the policy. That's like the party platform. They don't really believe it. So that's something you can appeal to. And once you have targeted that piece of psychological data, namely the desire that there be a perfect being, then you've got a good argument. Every other innate desire, natural desire, inner desire, not something conditioned by advertising, not something that only some people have, like the Red Sox whoop the Yankees, or the Yankees whoop the Red Sox, or we go to the Land of Oz, or we fly through the air like Superman, but something that everybody has, like sex, or a hunger, or thirst, or curiosity, or friendship. Every other desire corresponds to an objective reality. How meaningless it would be if we fell in love but there were no women. Or if we were curious but there was no knowledge. Or if we were lonely but there were no other people, there was no friendship possible. That would be meaningless. Every natural desire corresponds to an object. That's why they don't want to believe that there is a natural desire for God. Because then they'd either have to say, therefore there is a God, or that's the one and only desire that doesn't correspond to an object. In which case, you have an elaborate design regulating the relationship between human desires and the objective universe, such that each of these other desires leads you, like an appetizer, into a delicious 12-course meal, and then when you get the main course, there isn't any. Each of them stimulates your hunger so that when you die and it comes to the biggie, there ain't no biggie. Well, that's design. That's demonic design. That's sadistic design. So either there's a good God or a bad God. There's some sort of God, because there's incredible design in correspondence between human desires and the real world. That might at least give them pause, especially if they have ever felt in themselves this mysterious longing that I think St. Augustine and C.S. Lewis talked the best about. Those are two very dangerous writers for atheists to read. I found that some atheists or agnostics respond to the argument from beauty. In the Handbook of Christian Apologetics, which Father Fuseli and I wrote together, he wrote most of the chapter on the 24 arguments for the existence of God, but I wrote a couple of them. One was the argument for desire, the other was the argument from beauty. It's the shortest argument, and students very often say, that's my favorite argument. The argument goes as follows. There is the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, therefore there is a God. I happen to know three ex-atheists or agnostics who were converted by the St. Matthew Passion. Two of them were philosophers. I'm not sure exactly how to formulate that argument logically, but it's sort of like you just see it. It's a window.
That's grief.
Yeah.
Joseph Rastier, before he was Pope, said, in the end of the day, there are only two arguments for Christianity. One, the saint she has reduced, and second, the art that has grown in her womb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ben Balthasar said that, too.
That's where you got it.
Yep. Of course, the most beautiful thing in the world is a saint. And that's the absolutely unanswerable argument. And that's what did, in fact, convert the world. Nobody ever won an argument with Mother Teresa. Nobody.
No, of course not.
You can only ignore her. Chesterton said, there's only one conclusive argument against Christianity, Christians. But there's only one conclusive argument for it, Christians. But we're looking at intellectual arguments now. The argument from truth, I find not very effective. 100 years ago, it was. The Augustinian argument. The human mind has the capability of understanding eternal and necessary truths, like 2 and 2 are 4. Doesn't that mean that it must be in contact with a superior mind? Once in a while, you'll find an atheist who's impressed by that argument. I'm thinking of Kai Nielsen, who's a Platonist atheist. He believes in Platonic forms, eternal truths. Well, how can there be eternal ideas without a mind to think them? How can these ideas just be without any ontological place? But that's too abstract for most people. Yet, if you focus on not theoretical truths, like 2 and 2 is 4, but on practical truths, like ideals, like perfect justice, or perfect peace, or perfect love, where do we get that idea? We're a bunch of stupid, selfish, idiotic, ignorant apes. How could we formulate such an ideal? It's like a pussycat demanding to be a lion, but there are no lions. That might move them. But that's really the argument from desire. The moral argument is probably the single most popular argument in the entire history of human thought. The older version of it is there is an objective and absolute moral law, a natural law, and therefore there must be a lawgiver. That argument is much weaker today because moral relativism is so rife. And the words natural law in some quarters are viewed as an invitation to combat or a kind of obscenity. Got to be careful about those words. So I think Cardinal Newman's more modern version of the moral argument is much more effective. Even the moral relativist will usually have one absolute left, namely conscience. The fact that well over 90% of the people who are with us in opposing Obamacare because he won't grant the conscience exception for religious people have no idea what the church is about with regard to contraception. But they believe in freedom of conscience. So even a moral relativist will say, there's one absolute. They won't use the word absolute, but you ask them, suppose your conscience tells you that, let's say you want to be a pacifist, and my conscience tells me that I ought to enlist in a war. Would it ever be morally right for you to enlist in the war that you personally found violated your conscience? No. And would it be right for me to do the opposite? No. Well, then it's never wrong, it's never right for anybody to deliberately disobey your own individual conscience, right? Oh, so your conscience has absolute authority, right? Why? What do you mean, why? Well, where did your conscience come from? Your parents? Why are you bowing down to them as if they're God? Society? Are they infallible? Is it just the accident of your ancestry, heredity, environment? Why are you treating your conscience as if it's a prophet of God, when in fact it's just an accident? It's a very dangerous argument to use because it might turn them into Raskolnikovs. It's like, you know, you're right. I got to kill my conscience. I once had an argument with a couple of very bright feminists in an ethics class. We were arguing about abortion. And I challenged them to give me a single argument that justified abortion that didn't justify infanticide. And they tried, and I shot down their arguments, I thought, pretty well. And after class, they came to me and said, Professor, congratulations, we didn't think you could do it. You're very rational, you changed our mind. I said, oh, good, you're pro-life now. No, we're pro-infanticide.
Oh, God.
So when you make a reductio ad absurdum argument, it can go either way. Dostoevsky's famous line, if there is no God, everything is permissible. That's one version of the moral argument. Obviously, not everything is permissible. Therefore, there must be a God, a supreme authority. But it could go the other way. If there is no God, everything is permissible. and there is no God. I am an atheist. Therefore, I have to abandon all morality. I have to kill my conscience, because my conscience is just a little God inside. And we're not really freed from God until we're freed from conscience. So that's dangerous. You need discernment and prayer before you use that. Oh my goodness, I've talked much too long. I wanted to give you at least a half hour. Well, I do have a half hour left for questions. I'm always impressed by how polite Catholic audiences are in listening to monologues. And I conclude it's because they believe in purgatory. So your purgatory is over, and now the beginnings of heaven dialogue.
Dr. Craig, I had you 35 years ago at BC, and you introduced me to C.S. Lewis as Chesterton, so I thank you. And your mannerisms are the same as they were 35 years ago. And an example of someone who is willing to say that he was wrong, a great intellectual, I think, is Blessed John Henry Newman. In his Apologia, basically, it's a string of instances where he shows you where he was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He came to a conclusion different from where he'd come before. That's why I think he's, for the modern times, he's a very, very important figure.
Augustine's another one.
Yes.
Even after his conversion, he made some theological mistakes that he apologized for.
Dr. Creef, you have said that great saints are made from great sinners, and while that is often true, that is certainly not always true. What about Teresa of Lisieux, for instance?
Thomas Aquinas.
Or Thomas Aquinas, or Mother Teresa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's not...
Oh, this is not a justification for sin. There must have been such people in Paul's day. Where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. The next verse. What then? Shall we abound in sin so that God may abound in grace? No. God forbid. That's not who we are.
Lucas says sin
boldly.
Pick up what you get, But now look, you talk about all these arguments. But he says you've got, Newman said no one was ever converted by an argument.
No, but they might be converted out of an assured attitude towards atheism by argument. I think arguments are very good at planting doubts. They do the opposite of what they seem to do. They seem to close the case. Instead, they open the case.
Oh, that's a good formulation, yeah.
Okay. A young guy, Theus Dynol, says that, you know, we can't have free will. He believes that every choice you make is already somehow kind of programmed into us. Where we're going to, because of who we are, we're going to make certain choices. Not really.
Well, in that case, we can dispense with lawyers and judges.
We're
just machines. All we have to do is push buttons. Because when the Coke machine makes a mistake, we don't preach to it and tell it to go to confession. We kick it. That's a very dangerous position. If anyone really thinks through the consequences of a denial of free will, the consequences are radical. Thomas Aquinas' argument for free will is wonderfully simple. If there is no free will, then all praising, all blaming, all rewarding, all punishing, all counseling, and all commanding is literally meaningless. You don't do those things to determine machines. So that's like, if there is no God, everything is permissible. If there is no free will, then all moral language is meaningless. Most people will not embrace that conclusion. Therefore, all moral language is meaningless.
I met someone who said, I don't believe in free will, but I have to act as if it existed because I cannot act otherwise.
That was basically William James in Pragmatism. He tells the wonderful story of being in the middle of the street around 1900. He lived in Boston, and there were a lot of philosophy societies in Boston at the time. And he said, he first of all distinguished questions into what he called live issues and dead issues. And most of philosophy is dead issues. They made no difference to life. But free will and God and immortality were three big live issues. And he could never make up his mind to his dying day on either one of those three. He remained agnostic all his life, but fascinated with all three questions. So he tells the parable, well, I was trying to make up my mind whether to believe in free will or not, and here I was in the street, and I saw on the right-hand side of the street the Free Willers Association, and on the left-hand side of the street, the Determinists Club. And it was getting cold in the middle of the street. And I knew I had to go to some warm place. So I went to the Determinist Club. I figured they're more scientific. I knocked on the door. The porter said, so what do you want? I said, I want to come in and join. Oh, why did you come here? And I said, I came here of my own free will. So he... So now I'm in the middle of the street, and I'm getting even colder, and the only other place to go is the Free Willers Association. So I knocked on the door, and the porter said, what do you want? I said, I want to join. And he said, why did you come here? And I said, well, they kicked me out across the street, so I had no alternative. And he said, I've been in the street ever since. But that's a good point. You can make a free will decision to believe in free will.
It's more a comment, Dr. Craig, but I'm interested if you would have a response. Many of us here, I'm sure, celebrate funerals. And as you were speaking about how, in many ways, the most compelling argument against atheism is desire. You know, I have found myself oftentimes in preaching at funerals. You know, I think many of us, if not all of us, would agree that, you know, pastorally, it's such a grace-filled moment.
Right.
People are really listening.
Right.
And in many ways, in their deepest experience of grief, if you can effectively preach to them that, you know, that heaven is the fulfillment of all of our desires, and that, you know, in this time of sadness and pain and struggle and so on, that this is just a moment.
Yeah.
And that heaven, again, is that fulfillment of our deepest desire. I mean, it's been my experience, I'm sure for many of us, that message can really get through and can touch hearts.
Even though they may not,
you know, want to hear, you know, more particular doctrine and so on.
This is true.
I think from a natural level, it
God opens the door there.
Yeah.
In order to get us to get our attention, God kills us. That's rather radical, but if we lived forever, if there was no death, that would be virtually the end of religion. Just imagine if the geneticists who are now working on the immortality pill, there are quite a few hundred of them that think we can do artificial immortality by genetic engineering. Imagine they got their way. Wow. I don't remember many sermons, even that I heard as an adult, but I vividly remember one that I heard as a child. Don't remember even who it was that died. It wasn't anybody close to me, but the preacher said, preached on the text, we do not grieve as do those who have no hope. And he said, of course we grieve, but there's two different ways of grieving. Just imagine that you had no hope and there was nothing after death. And compare that grief with the grief that we now have. Two totally different worldviews. And that's kind of a Pascal's wager. If you can't prove either one, why would you opt for the one that gives you meaningless misery and despair rather than the one that gives you hope?
That's great. A year or two ago, I think it was on Holy Thursday, Benedict spoke about the question, suppose medical science could allow us to live 150, 200 or more years. He said that wouldn't be a good thing.
Well, I think
because he said humanity would become immensely old and there'd be no chance for the young.
Like Howard Hughes. Read about his life. He tried to extend it by medical technology. It was miserable. I think we can make a kind of analogical scientific experiment about what artificial immortality would be like. Just take a dozen eggs and keep it in your kitchen for a month and don't refrigerate it. I think you can smell the kind of world that would be. Because we are, as C.S. Lewis says, we're like eggs at present. We're designed to hatch, and if we don't hatch, we go bad.
Sorry that I got in late. Maybe you addressed this at the beginning.
I absolutely agree that it's much easier to turn around a car in motion than to start it, but in my experience in my parish, it's getting the car started. There's a lot of sloth intellectually. I mean, I love the atheists. I wish I had a parish full of them.
Yeah.
Because at least they're interested in truth.
Yep.
But in my experience, and I think in New England in general, you intellectuals have led us astray, but you haven't led us into your own error. You've led us into this, you know, now we just don't care anymore.
Yep.
And I was wondering if you could address that, you know, that despair, like maybe the Kierkegaard talks about, you know, not wanting to be what we are.
I think that is peculiarly New Englandish, the frozen chosen. I'm haunted by a phone call that I made to Dr. Kipley when three of my four kids went to free Cana courses in marriage preparation, and none of them heard a word about natural family planning, except one priest sort of laughed at it. So I wrote a letter to the cardinal, who was then Cardinal Law, and I said, isn't NFP supposed to be part of all free Cana instruction? And he wrote a very nice personal letter back saying, yes, it is. I commanded this to be done in every parish. And at least in these three parishes, it wasn't done, three different parishes. So I called up Dr. Kipley in Minnesota, who started the Couples of Double League, and I didn't tell him who I was. I just said why I was calling, and he said, you're from Massachusetts, right? Now, I think then they didn't have phones that registered the numbers. I said, how did you know? He said, that's the one place we can't get a foot in the door.
Interesting.
He said, the pastors don't like anything controversial, and this is too new and controversial. I said, well, why is that? He said, well, it's a New England temperament. They're not usually outright heretics, except in Jesuit theology departments. But they don't like anything controversial, especially something that's as unabashedly Catholic as that. They like to be comforted. I also am haunted by another personal experience that proves to me that what you say is true. I wrote for a homily service once. Anybody ever hear of Good News Homily Service? Yeah, it was for lazy priests. model sermons. And all the ones that I thought were good, the person who employed me, whose name I will not mention, thought were bad. And all the ones that I thought were bad, he thought were good. The really bad one was one that I thought was just full of cliches and platitudes and something comforting. He said, that's what we want. And the one that I thought was really good that was about a healing. I said, we're angry when we see little children die or innocence oppressed. We should be angry, not at God, but at the devil. Jesus came as a full human being, therefore he was angry at evil and injustice. He said, you can't do that. You can't whip people up like that. I said, you mean you have to put them to sleep? He said, no, you have to have grace. What is grace? You mean divine grace? No, human grace. So I got fired. Yeah, sloth is a biggie. Much harder to put out a fire than to start one. What do you do? Well, a few verbal kicks in anatomically correct places are sometimes very useful. If none of your parishioners ever complains about anything you say at the homily, I don't think you're doing your job.
Right on. Right.
Pope Benedict, I think, has been actively working this angle of desire, both with his whole Courtyard of the Gentiles project, and even in Assisi last October, where he invited not just representatives of all the world religions, but also an honest atheist who was a seeker. Mm-hmm. And he's actively trying to engage the seekers, and I think set a standard for the church as a whole to try to make room, like the ancient Courtyard of the Gentiles, where they could go into that outer part of the temple and ask their questions and at least start to hear from Catholics what the reason for the hope that we carry within is. And but I've discovered in general that with a lot of the Catholics we serve, there's a real fear of atheists. primarily because most of the atheists they know are more intelligent
mm-hmm.
in terms of received a greater education.
Mm-hmm.
They'll come up with these types of arguments. If we were to equip, would you be able to essentialize for us a couple arguments which you think would be able to work for a typical blue-collar Catholic in a parish to engage the very smart soon-to-be brother-in-law who came in with his Ivy League degree?
This is exactly what I have been asked to do and am now preparing a series of 6 or 7 5-minute videotape things that are going to be used by, who's this Orthodox Jewish fellow in California who has the big TV and internet ministry? What's his name?
Is it Levitt?
No. He's a rabbi. Anyway, that's exactly what they said has to be done. And the basis for that is not just some clever scheme, some aspiration, some hope, some human desire. Maybe this is the best method. It's an infallibly guaranteed divine promise. Seek and you shall find. Seekers are good. We have to turn our people into seekers.
Mm-hmm.
Seeking is not just a nice thing to do. It's a if it's honest, it's a guaranteed way to heaven. Open your eyes, you'll see the light. There it is.
But how can your blue-collar parishioner use that to deal with the semi-atheist Ivy League brother-in-law who's coming into family? That's the question you asked.
There's an incredible crisis of confidence, not just in terms of the religious illiteracy among Catholics, but also in terms of this engagement at the arguments underneath, the real human arguments. I think because to a large degree they've received the truths of the faith almost as Platonic forms that have no real rootedness in practical life. Benedict defined secularism as living et si Deus non derecho, as if God didn't exist and
mm-hmm.
we weren't a given, and that's where many of the people that we're serving are.
Who is it? One Catholic author, Ralph Martin, says most Catholics have been sacramentalized without being evangelized.
Yeah, that's true.
Thus the new evangelization. We have to learn from the evangelicals. They're not afraid to engage. This is not just a task for some people. This is part of the poster. The wanted poster.
Regarding your comment on NFP, I think that most of the baggage that people have regarding that is dissipated amongst the young. In our marriage preparation course, we ask the young people at the beginning, what do you want to learn about? Obviously, we have what we're going to give them, but it happens that we want to learn about NFP. So I think amongst young people, all the baggage is gone because they've lived in the devastation
yep.
of contraception,
yep. Yep.
and they want to see the other side. So, I think the hesitancy on the part of some pastors is going to cause great problems. I don't think it will. I mean, it's a breath of fresh air.
Well, you know,
a lot of young people. A
couple of years ago, I teach at a Protestant Evangelical College in New York City on Wednesdays, the King's College in the Empire State Building, and also at BC, and taught an ethics course in both places, and I wanted the widest possible variety of exposure to different approaches in both courses, so I had the same curriculum in both courses. One of them was a Catholic book by Steve Kelmeyer called Sex of the Secular City, which was basically about the foundations for the Catholic view of sexuality. And it was a chapter on NFP and a chapter on birth control. And I told my Protestant students, you should know this. I'm not trying to convert you, but you should know it. They were wildly enthusiastic about it. Almost all of them said, the Catholic Church is right about this, including contraception. Taught the same course at BC, no interest at all.
Typical.
So then I told the Protestants they were more Catholic than the Catholics, and the Catholics they were more Protestant than the Protestants. I confused them.
The argument that you referred to about snobbery, this idea that I mean, I find it sometimes impacting to suggest to somebody, well, to an atheist, that 99.9% of people who've ever existed were believers, mm-hmm. and you are right now in the history of humanity just that tiny percent.
1%.
Is that? I mean, I don't find it always as effective. It doesn't seem to move people out of their snow.
We can't judge what's effective. You plant doubts. Maybe months or years later, they'll remember that. And I can't imagine the average atheist being totally content with being a snob. Content with being one of the elite 1%, yes. But when you use the name snob and you use that word, there's a power to that word. And realize that my desire to be in the 1%, to be superior to everybody, there's a moral aspect to that. That's a fault. That's looking on these people, including the greatest minds in history, as fools. I have to say that. I have to believe that Thomas Aquinas was insane. That's a difficulty. They don't see that immediately, but put seeds in there.
Let's think of themselves as progress. We have progressed in time, but snobbery is a better retort to progress.
Yeah. We've progressed, and therefore we are much happier and much more at peace and less violent, and we hate each other less. Yes, we've progressed enormously. And the suicide rate has decreased spectacularly, especially in industrialized nations. Yes, we've progressed.
I understand the notion of the argument from desire and how that could work to bring hope to the despairing. You mentioned about funerals, but how do you bring hope for the presumptuous? That's what I think most of the people at my funerals are. They, oh yes, of course, he's in a better place. He's all set.
Mm-hmm.
There's an approach to God among our people that, oh, you know, it's automatic, or well, I was baptized, so you know, I'm going to go to heaven. We're all set.
Dorothy Day said she had two tasks: to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. So I think we have to also afflict the comfortable. I think it's dangerous to make that a kind of a psychological ploy or program. I think you're comfortable, so I'm going to afflict you, and I think you're afflicted, so I'm going to comfort you. Just tell the whole truth, and let the chips fall where they may. But I think this grace-filled moment at a funeral is also a good time to play on people's natural fear of death and the unknown. Yes. We don't know. We know that 2 and 2 are 4, and we know that we have 5 fingers on each hand, but we don't know what's going to happen to us when we die. So we better get ready. In the words of the bumper sticker, study for your finals, read your Bible.
You brought up Chesterton, that the greatest argument against Christianity are Christians, and the greatest argument for are Christians. Second Vatican Council was talking about the same thing in Gaudium et Spes, that one of the greatest causes for modern atheism is the, I'm not quoting directly, but scandalous behavior of some Christians. But in terms of living in a celebrity culture and the greatest argument of the beauty being real Christians, two parts of the question. How best do you think we can introduce atheists to Jesus Christ? Gandhi himself was attracted by Christ but turned off by Christians. And then second, would you suggest a few different saints who might be compelling figures for modern atheists to have those bombs of the doubts planted?
Well, obviously, if atheists read the Gospels, unless they're very hard-hearted, they're at least going to say, well, that's impressive. How come you're not like that? Now, the last Christian died on the cross. Well, that's some progress. Even Nietzsche, in certain moments, had words of praise for Christ as well as words of blame for him. But as to the saints, it's surprisingly unpredictable because I don't have that much experience, but in my limited experience, the saint that has
made inroads in the lives of doubters more powerfully than anybody else is Teresa of Lisieux. Which you wouldn't expect. She's so severe, so uncompromising, so total.
But she's also simple in comparison with wacky complexity. St. Edith Stein was moved by the experience of St. Teresa of Avila's prayer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the truth after pulling an all-nighter reading it. You know, I was wondering if you'd go in the direction of martyrs at all.
Definitely.
Because that somebody who's willing to die joyfully singing, who was compos mentis, heading to the stake, is something that does raise those doubts about the most important questions, too.
That's what converted the world, those hard-hearted, pragmatic Romans. What's with these Christians, anyway? Why are they forgiving their enemies and singing hymns as the lions are eating them? They're either nuts or we're wrong.
Of the many self-proclaimed atheists and agnostics you've spoken to, how many would you say, well, certainly not an exact count, but maybe a percentage, are familiar with the Christian intellectual tradition?
Very, very few, especially in the media. Polls have established that. There was one poll that asked a large cross-section of media people, have you been in any church or synagogue or mosque in the last 12 months for any other purpose than a wedding or a funeral? 9% said yes.
And the reporting shows that, because it's so skewed. Yeah.
And when they want some religious angle, they always go to their primary source, Richard O'Brien or somebody like that, because they know nothing. I mean, he's the expert. Yeah. So challenge them to open your mind and look at these insane people, explore your enemy. This has to be done.
Or
I don't know how.
Being aware that there is a Christian intellectual tradition.
Yeah. I don't know how the media culture got so massively into the enemy's hands, but that's the most powerful institution in our society.
Right.
And that has to change somehow.
Well, the thing is, an awful lot of us would be probably scared to speak to media people because we're so afraid that we'll be misquoted or misrepresented and everything. They really need people to speak to them and to be an open ear. Maybe Archbishop Dolan in New York is a little bit like that, that he's friendly towards them and he will spend time with them, but a lot of us are just scared to be anywhere near a reporter.
Go live in the Lower East Side of New York City for a year and interact with Jews there and get a big mouth and then go back and that's what we need. We're too polite.
We're too nice.
Yes. Jesus was not nice.
Some years ago, the American Supreme Court realized that atheism is also similar to a faith in certain aspects. And I've always thought that that might be a good tact when discussing with an atheist, you know, really pointing out the fact that they have a real faith in their atheism. Any ideas about how you could pursue that?
I don't know. I'm not decided. I know that's a popular philosophical approach, especially among Protestants. I'm a little suspicious of it because it gives them too much comfort. Well, I've got my faith and you've got your faith and reason is not on the table anymore, so let's just agree to differ. I have my religion of atheism, you have your religion of God, I think mine is more intelligent than yours, let's not argue. That's the conversation stopper. I think reason is the conversation opener. But it is useful for the atheist to realize that there are presuppositions, questionable presuppositions in his atheism. That is not the obvious given position.
Getting started, Dr. Craig?
Yes.